Good afternoon and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have six cases being submitted today, three of which will have oral argument. On my left is Justice Bill Meyer, and on my right is Judge Terry Livingston. Megan, will you call the first case? Let's proceed. I'd like to remind everyone that the audio of these oral arguments is available. Is it on our website? On our website. All right.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. If I said to you, "You look nice today," you might think that was a little different than if I said, "You look nice today." And that is one of the reasons, because if you look at the transcript of what I just said, those two things would look exactly the same. But they weren't. And the reason is because of my tone, because of my inflection, because of the way I said it. That's one of the reasons in a sexual harassment case, it's not particularly amenable to a summary judgment. The interactions between the people need to be evaluated in context by looking at the tone or the inflection or the interaction or the effect it had on the person who heard it. Because those are all things that have to be evaluated in determining whether or not it was subjectively offensive or objectively offensive. Because saying "you look nice today" might not offend you, but looking you up and down and giving you a little wink and going, "Ooh, you look nice today," well, that might offend you. And those have to be evaluated under those circumstances.
But in the summary judgment context, we take all of your evidentiary proof as true. So if that is the case, then how do you get over the hurdle that nothing happened after the appellant reported this situation?
The only reason that nothing happened after he reported it is because he was so distraught that he went off on leave and never returned. So that does not support an argument that nothing happened because they took action. It only supports an argument that nothing happened because Eric wasn't around to be harassed anymore. But that doesn't relieve them of responsibility, because they have responsibility for a number of things before Eric ever left and went off on leave. If, for example, the conduct resulted in a tangible employment action, which we're arguing could be either the transfer or the determination of transfer or the constructive discharge, then they are responsible for all of the harassment that occurred, even before Eric reported it, because it was done by their supervisor. And so under quid pro quo sexual harassment, it is vicarious liability. It's, of course, our position that telling someone who's been harassed, "Well, you know, if you want to, you can go to Louisville and work there, but that's pretty much all we're going to do about it," is A, not an appropriate response, and B, a tangible employment action.
I perceived from their brief that that wasn't new, but your response was too little, too late, like that was a new offer. So which was it?
Well, I don't know. I think they never offered him. It's the appellee's position that what they offered him was a chance to do something that he wanted to do. And it's Eric's position that, "No, I didn't want to work out of Louisville. It's too far away. I had a brand new baby at home. There's no way I wanted to add that travel and time on, and there's just no way I could accomplish that." He had previously, a long time earlier, talked about transferring to North Carolina, I think it was North Carolina, because He had some kids from his first wife who lived there. But that was a long ago conversation, and that wasn't what they offered to do. They didn't offer to send him to North Carolina. They offered to let him go to Louisville. They just sort of threw that out there. It is our position that they did not, in fact, offer to allow him a different supervisor or allow him to go wherever he wanted to go or allow him to transfer, as they're saying. That I believe that's their position, and I believe that that is not supported by the summary judgment facts.
So your position is they did not say you can stay here and we will remove Wadley?
Absolutely, they did not.
Before?
Correct.
Before the letter transmitted to you to which you responded too little too late?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
At any time before that letter, Eric was never aware that that was an option. And that's supported by the fact that his own doctor sent them a letter that said, you know, he can't go back there because he cannot work for that supervisor. It's totally destroying him. He can't even function. And he can't return there because he can't work for that man. And they never responded to that. They didn't write back and go, oh, he doesn't have to do that, or there's a misunderstanding. He doesn't need to be working for the man, or any other options that they're now saying were available. They did not respond to that. And by inference, Eric believed that if he went back, he would have had to work for Mr. Wadley. He was unaware that Mr. Wadley, in fact, had gone on medical leave because he himself was claiming to be distressed by the situation.
But did he leave after they sent the letter? He voluntarily quit working there after the letter was sent.
Are you talking about Eric?
Yes.
Yes, he did not. Well, he did not return, correct.
Okay, but he didn't terminate his employment until after the letter was sent. So he was on notice that he would not have to go back to work for Wadley, with Wadley there, Wadley around. Wadley's gone. So why is it that he couldn't go back to work pursuant to his medical advice when Wadley wouldn't be around?
He was not ever informed that Wadley would not be around.
But you were informed, and you were his lawyer, and he left after that, right?
I was not informed that Wadley would not be around until I sent them a letter saying he can't come back, he's done, he's going to go elsewhere, he will not be returning. And then their lawyer sent me a letter saying, wait a minute, you know, we're prepared to offer him new options, or we've offered him new options, or, you know, we want to enter into discussions. And at that point was the time when we said, you know, he's it's too little too late. There's no way he's going to be able to come back to work there now.
All right.
So, but prior to that time, he was not aware of the position with Mr. Wadley. But there are other factors that go into that as well, Your Honor, including the fact that They will, and if you compare it to the language, for example, in Walmart versus Davis, where they say it's interesting to note that the employer goes to great lengths to avoid even admitting that they were talking about sexual harassment, or that there was any sexual harassment, or that there was a suspicion of sexual harassment. And it's the same thing here, that waste management goes to humongous lengths to avoid even the slightest indication that they might ever have believed that there was any hint of sexual harassment in this case. And so Eric never had any validation of his complaints or any belief that they were going to take him seriously or any belief that they were going to treat him seriously when he returned or any belief that they were going to do anything other than find a way to get rid of him after he did return, because they perceived him as a troublemaker and a complainer. So instead of validating his complaints, they determined that he must have either invited him or it was all a misunderstanding.
All right, so your position is they can't say, we're going to take all these steps to solve a problem, when on the other side they say there's not a problem.
Correct.
They won't acknowledge a problem.
They did not acknowledge a problem, nor did they ever take any steps to inform him of what was going on, or that there was going to be any further investigation, or that they had concluded their investigation, or that they weren't going to conclude their investigation. They just, and I believe they even testified to the fact that they just left it hanging and moved on. And so that is not an environment that Eric would be able to go back into. I don't think it's an environment that any reasonable person would go back into. For someone to say, well, I'm not going to conclude that anything happened to you, and I'm not going to validate your complaints, and And he had no information that they wouldn't try the same thing again that they did after he complained, which is, I know that you're so distraught that you can barely function and that you insisted on meeting off the premises so you wouldn't even have to be around this man, but we're going to force you to sit in a room and confront him and tell him all the reasons why you're so upset, and then we'll see what happens. He didn't have any indication that they wouldn't try something like that again.
What was the evidence regarding the conclusion of that meeting at the IHOP? In other words, was a result achieved at the end of that meeting?
No. What they told him was that they were going to take the information that he'd given them and investigate it. And the sum total of their investigation was to have a meeting subsequent to that where they forced him to sit together in a room. But they didn't interview anybody else or take any notes or prepare a report or do anything other than that. That was the sum total of what they did. And we do have the notes that their human resources manager made from that meeting, which do indicate that Eric showed them both the messages that he received from Mr. Wadley and the messages that he sent to him. Both were recorded in those notes. And the messages clearly state that they were messages of a romantic interest. And I just don't think there's any way that you can get around that was, those were sexual overtures on the part of Mr. Wadley. And Mr. Wadley, of course, since has admitted in his deposition that he's a homosexual. So there's no question that the overtures were made because of sex. And you can tell from the messages themselves that Eric was asking him to please leave him alone. One of the text messages from Mr. Wadley says, "Fine, I'll leave you alone, sir. Good luck." And then, of course, he starts right back up again with overtures and telling him that he loves him and asking him if he'll move with him to Colorado and be his partner. And I believe the last "I love you" message was the one that had Eric finally go to Mr. Wadley's boss and have the discussion at the IHOP. Even if there was not a tangible employment action, even if there is not a finding of quid pro quo harassment, which of course we believe there is, then under the hostile environment claim, there is not a requirement for tangible employment action, but they would get their affirmative defense submitted to the fact finder if this was a case that was presented to a fact finder. And then the fact finder would be asked as to whether or not their action was prompt and remedial in nature. And that's one of the reasons I think these cases are not amenable to summary judgment and they really have to go to a jury, because once you determine that the conduct itself was sexually harassing, then the determination needs to be made as to whether or not there was a tangible employment action. If there was, they don't get an affirmative defense, and if there wasn't, then the fact finder needs to decide whether it was prompt, remedial, and appropriate under the circumstances. And you've got the guys that are doing the investigation are the very ones that Mr. Wadley had complained of being sexually harassed by. They're the very ones who were involved in the shrimping incident on the premises. And they're the very ones who were showing Mr. Wadley pornography on their computers at the office. And so those are the people that Waste Management had conducting the investigation. And that's something that a fact finder really needs to determine if it's appropriate or not. These kinds of cases are very fact-specific in every aspect. And they're ones that depend in a large measure on the evaluation of the witnesses and their credibility and their susceptibility and how offended they are by certain types of conduct and what their intent is. And those are things that need to be evaluated by a jury. Thank you.
May it please the court, Holly Williamson on behalf of Waste Management, and Mr. Hartman is going to be delivering his argument on behalf of Mr. Wadley. As I'm listening to Ms. Hutchison, what I'm hearing is just a bunch of argument without articulating what the law is. In this case, they've made a number of claims: constructive discharge, two forms of sexual harassment, the quid pro quo and the sexually hostile working environment, retaliation, negligence, and assault. And I do believe that they have dropped the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim against Waste Management. The easiest way, as I perceive it, to argue this is to start with the constructive discharge claim, because it affects the quid pro quo claim and it affects the retaliation claim, because that's one of the claims that they say is the adverse employment action or the tangible employment action. A constructive discharge claim requires, at the beginning, facts that show a working environment that is intolerable to a reasonable person. And an intolerable working condition under the case law is something that is more than what most of us or some of us would perceive as even being harassment in the workplace. It requires demotions, reductions in salaries, reduction in job responsibilities, reassignments to menial jobs, badgering, harassment, or humiliation by the employer calculated to encourage the employee's resignation. Offers of early retirement that would make the employee worse off than he or she was before the offer. And facts that show that the employer intended to force the employee to resign. And the facts in this case show, of course, none of those existed because Waste Management tried very hard to get Mr. Cox to come back to work for it. Mr. Cox contends that he was constructively discharged because he didn't like Waste Management's investigation and the way it was conducted. He did not appreciate that Waste Management did not report the results of the investigation to him, although he left on the same day that they were in the middle of the investigation, and Waste Management was told not to contact him. And they don't like and claim, as part of their constructive discharge, that Waste Management did not terminate or transfer Mr. Wadley. As the case law demonstrates that we've provided to the court in our briefs, none of these issues, their disagreement with the investigation, their disagreement with whether Waste Management delivered the results of the investigation to Mr. Cox, and whether Waste Management terminated or transferred Wadley, supports a constructive discharge claim. None of these are intolerable working conditions that he was exposed to. Mr. Cox, in his deposition, said that the intolerable working conditions were that he didn't feel like Waste Management cared about him and that he didn't trust Waste Management. Well, you can go to most employees of any Fortune 500 company in this country, and they'll probably say that they don't think that their employer cares about them and that they don't trust their employer. And if that were the standard, then y'all would be a lot busier than you are today on these cases.
Well, how about your list on page 25 of your brief, which on page 26 you say 8 instances, yet if we read the 8 items here, we'll see there's considerably more than 8 instances.
Are you talking about the text messages?
Yes.
Yeah, the text messages. Well, because a number of those text messages are not in any way harassing or sexual in nature. They are just to let you know I care about you. Happy New Year. I have everything.
Your number 8 says, and sent Cox a few texts stating he loved Cox.
And these are not intolerable working conditions. These are sporadic text messages.
Kind of sounds like a fact question, kind of like, was it negligence? Was it intolerable?
But he didn't quit at that time. And the case law also says that if you find your working conditions to be intolerable, you have to go ahead and terminate your employment. He did not. He went out on leave, stayed out on leave for 4 months, and then after his lawyer informed Waste Management he wasn't coming back, and Waste Management informed his lawyer, wait a minute, we have, you know, we'll transfer him if he wants to be transferred. We'll reassign
okay,
Wadley.
So are you acknowledging that that hadn't happened before because you're using the future tense, we will? So had you informed him before, we'll move Wadley, you can go to Louisville? Had you told him that before?
Yes, Your Honor. That
Where
is our
is
position.
That?
That is, it's in one of our footnotes. It deals with the doctor's note, and it deals with our witness's testimony. But for purposes of this argument, I'm accepting what they're saying because it's a summary judgment motion. So for purposes of this argument, I'm saying that their position is the first time they were notified was in that letter.
Right.
And Mr. Wadley also has an obligation to be reasonable before he quits his job. That's what the case law says. And a reasonable person would engage in some dialogue, some interaction with their employer before they just up and quit. What has happened during the 4 months that I've been gone? Where is Mr. Wadley? What are my options? And even after Waste Management made those various offers, he declined to return. And he quit. He absolutely quit. So we start with the constructive discharge claim. And the constructive discharge has to be because of retaliation or because Wadley made the decision to retaliate against him because he refused to give in to sexual request, which would be the quid pro quo form of sexual harassment. There are two forms, as I'm sure this court knows, the sexually hostile working environment and the quid pro quo. The quid pro quo, excuse me, requires that there be a tangible employment action by the person who is creating or asking for the sexual request. In this case, there is nothing that shows that Mr. Wadley engaged in a tangible employment action, adverse action against Mr. Cox as a result of any alleged rebuffing of advances. So the quid pro quo claim fails because there is no tangible employment action undertaken by Mr. Wadley. And the Walmart case out of Austin, Walmart versus Itz, and the Ewald case out of Corpus Christi confirm that, along with the circuit cases, that it has to be by the person that's engaging in the harassment. So the quid pro quo claim is gone. Now, the sexually hostile working environment, I'll start off with the affirmative defenses that we proved. Because with the sexually hostile working environment claim, we win because we proved our affirmative defenses. The Farragher and Ellerith cases provided the employers these defenses when the employers are able to show that they exercised reasonable care to prevent and correct promptly any sexually harassing behavior and that the employee unreasonably failed to take advantage of any preventative or corrective opportunities provided by the employer to avoid harm. In this case, Waste Management had a sexual harassment policy that Mr. Cox did not take advantage of until January 2nd of 2006. I can't remember what year it was. And he said that the reason he didn't take advantage of it because he wasn't certain of what was going on. He wasn't convinced that this was even sexual harassment. When he did make the report, Waste Management jumped on it immediately. They interviewed him that day. They interviewed him the next morning, and then they interviewed him in a group later on that day. Then they disciplined Mr. Wadley because he had overstepped his relationship with a subordinate. They suspended him without pay for 2 weeks and wrote him up and put it in his file.
Apparently never acknowledged there was any sexual harassment going on.
That's right, Your Honor. And the company doesn't have to agree with the employee. The testimony was that they couldn't figure out what Mr. Cox was trying to say. And that the company doesn't reach the same conclusion that the employee has reached does not mean that the company has failed to take corrective action and has failed to take preventative measures. In this case, they did take corrective action and had preventative measures. And the Baldwin case on the Fifth Circuit says you don't have to like what they did. You don't have to agree with what they did. But if what they did ended up ending the harassment that you say occurred, that's good enough. And I heard Ms. Hutchison say, well, it stopped because he took a leave of absence. Mr. Cox took a leave of absence. We don't know why it stopped. We contend it stopped because of the corrective action that we took. But Mr. Wadley could have called him, could have stopped by his house. The harassment could have continued notwithstanding that leave of absence. So it did work Mr. Wadley never contacted him again after we took our prompt corrective action. And the law also says that Mr. Cox will be denied any opportunities to proceed on a sexually hostile working environment if he fails to avoid the harm himself. And he unreasonably failed to take advantage of the opportunities. First of all, the sexual harassment policy that he waited until January 2nd to utilize. And then second of all, as the Baldwin case points out, he was given opportunities or options. In the Baldwin case, they gave the employee who complained about sexual harassment the option of either going to counseling with the supervisor that the employee said was harassing her, or to take a transfer. And in that case, the employee said no to both, and the employer fired that employee. And what the Fifth Circuit said is, you know what, the employee was unreasonable. They had, the employee may not have liked those options, but they did give that employee options, and the employee refused them. And therefore, the termination was neither retaliatory, it was not retaliatory, and it proved up the Farragher-Ellerith defense, the affirmative defense to the sexual hostile working environment claim.
And what was the unreasonable action taken by Mr. Cox?
That he refused to take advantage of the options that were provided to him. Even
we already discussed you didn't give him options for purposes of this hearing.
Well, no, Your Honor, I think it's undisputed that we gave him an option of transfer from the get-go. And what the Baldwin case says is that's good enough. And then we've cited other cases that say that that's good enough. That's not retaliatory. That is a reasonable response to someone who is complaining about harassment. Now, for purposes of summary judgment, that's undisputed, and it is undisputed that we sent the letter after Ms. Hutchison sent the letter to Waste Management. We have evidence in his psychiatric records that Waste Management gave him these options, and it's in a footnote in our brief, that Waste Management gave him these options before his lawyer ever sent the letter. And if you'd like, while Mr. Hartman's argument, I'll find that footnote here that shows you where in the record that is.
Did Waste Management ever inform Mr. Cox of the 2-week suspension?
Yes, Your Honor. In the letter to Ms. Hutchison, it sure did. But once again, he left on January 3rd. We were told not to contact him. And so there was no opportunity to meet with him and discuss with him what had transpired and to visit with him any more about the various options. He has to be reasonable. And he had counsel. Somebody should have engaged in some sort of interactive dialogue with a company rather than being unreasonable and just quitting the job. And the case law also says that we don't have to tell him what the outcome of the investigation is. As an employment lawyer, I typically don't. They usually know if somebody's been fired. They're there one day, they're gone the next. They usually know if someone's transferred. But typically, we don't go to them and tell them precisely what has been done with the other party. I'm going to go ahead and allow Mr. Hartman to give his argument. And thank you very much.
May it please the Court. Briefly, Your Honors, I'm just going to address the gap filler issue. As this Court is no doubt aware, the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that intentional infliction claims are reserved for those rare instances where a party has no other theory of redress against various parties. In this case, it's clear there's no gap. The appellant had a sexual harassment claim against Waste Management as well as an assault claim against both Waste Management and my client. There were other theories for redress, so there's no gap, so the intentional infliction claim disappears. As far as the assault claim, it's one of those claims where the facts are pretty simple. He was allegedly, if you believe what they say, he was touched on his shoulder and asked to come look at a map. I'm not aware of that ever being found to be an assault, whether in a jury or any finding. And that is basically the gist of their argument. They claim there's some other alleged statements or threats that I will find you at some distant time in the future. Again, under the case law, it's pretty clear there's got to be imminent harm. Threats of future harm aren't going to satisfy for an assault claim in Texas. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but they're pretty clear-cut on both those points for Mr. Wadley.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I have so much to rebut here. I just want to say, however, that in the brief and in the argument of counsel, I think I don't have to point out that she plays fast and loose, not only with the facts, but also with the holdings of the decisions that she cites. Baldwin is an 11th Circuit case. It's never been the law in the 5th Circuit. It's not today. And she stands up here and argues that Baldwin, the 5th Circuit, held. That's not true. And that case doesn't stand for the proposition that she cited it for, but I don't want to digress into that. The bottom line in this case is, are we going to recognize same-sex sexual harassment in this building or not? I'm talking about in this building being all the judges and the floors below, because same-sex harassment has been recognized by our Supreme Court. And in this case, I just can't fathom how these issues are not factual disputes. The context, as my co-counsel pointed out, is critical in these cases. They're claiming that Mr. Wadley was suspended and that Eric Cox is off voluntarily. Mental illness is not off voluntarily, Your Honors. He was off on mental health leave because of the actions of Tony Wadley sexually harassing him. He wasn't voluntarily absent from work. He was forced to the breaking point to be encountered by the man who has been sexually harassing him. And as Judge McCoy pointed out on page 26, there's far more than 8 instances of this examples of this conduct going on. It's repeated conduct. It's not only the 8 quotes and texts that are there, but this man is saying things to Eric Cox, for example, I'm an ex-police officer. I know where you live. I can find you. If you transfer, it doesn't matter where you go. I'll find you wherever you go. Now, I want to address this tangible employment issue, because anybody that believes if you live in South Fort Worth and you get transferred to work in Louisville and doesn't believe that that diminishes your ability to make money in that job, either doesn't live here or they're smoking crack. Because driving on 121 is a tollway. It is the gridlock of this area, and that absolutely would cause him to suffer an economic disadvantage. I mean, we're talking about a guy that collects garbage. For him to drive from South Fort Worth to Louisville on 121 every day is clearly, I wanted to quote what she said, doesn't make him worse off than before the offer. Well, of course that offer makes him worse off. To have to drive to Louisville, he has to tell his wife, I've got to be on the road an extra 2 hours because of nothing that I did, because I was sexually harassed by my supervisor. And what do? They punish me by transferring me out. Of course, that's not appropriate. I need to, in my remaining time, the Supreme Court in the Ellerth case, E-L-L-E-R-T-H, says that a tangible employment action is a company act, contrary to what counsel represents to you. It's not that to be done by the harasser, but it has to be related to the harassment. Of course, the tangible employment action that Mr. Cox suffered was as a result of the conduct of Tony Wadley. But it is a company act, so says the United States Supreme Court. And it was caused directly by the actions of Tony Wadley, i.e. in the sexual harassment. They were never told. It's not in the record anywhere that they couldn't contact Eric Cox. In fact, his doctor only said that they need to quit trying to move him back to work under Wadley. No one ever said that they were not to contact Eric. And then as to the gap filler, intentional infliction of emotional distress is available against the individual. We cannot sue an individual for sexual harassment. So that's the gap that cause of action fills. These issues are clearly within, they're factually disputed. They are not as a matter of law. I mean, reading her brief is like being on that show where they ask you a question and no matter what you say, wrong! As a matter of law, it's this. I mean, every time she cites a case, she cites it for the proposition that as a matter of law, for example, the case that she's, and I see I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for your fine arguments today. Your case is submitted.